Thank you, Leroy. You make me want to cry. I wish I wasn't deserving of the remark, but I do try. My name is Neely Daniel, and I'm an alcoholic, a member of the Northeast Group in Atlanta. Hi, everybody. Long before I ever took a drink of alcohol, I was a target to become an alcoholic. I had conflicts within, and when I did come into AA and took my inventory, I found that I felt very inadequate. I had an inferiority complex, very insecure. I found out some of these things about me when I did take the inventory. And my father was a Methodist minister. And he was very broad-minded in lots of things. He loved sports. We had all kind of games like flinch and rook and caroms and checkers and those things in our home. But we never had a game that was played with playing cards, because my father thought that they were meant for meant for people who were going to gamble. He thought it was wrong for me to dance. And because I had so much respect for his position, I did not dance. And I wanted to when I was in high school and college more than I wanted to do anything else, I think. And all these years, I had held that resentment inside of me. And that had smoldered. So when I had a drink of alcohol, I came up when I finished 2 years of college and began teaching in Atlanta schools. I went to Emory and continued my education. In a few years, I married. I continued to live in Decatur and continued to teach. The first place we went after we were married was to dinner one night with friends, and they served homebrew. This was during Prohibition. And I didn't like it. Didn't like the taste of it. But I drank some of it. And it seemed like every way we went, they served homebrew. And every time, I drank a little more. It wasn't long before I began to love it. And I never could get enough, and that was my pattern. And I never could get enough. I didn't get into too much trouble with homebrew. It was not available. When Prohibition was repealed, I loved the beer and I loved the wine. For about 10 years, I drank beer and wine. Got into no particularly trouble with it, except I was very, very dependent. I couldn't wait to get home from school for going to the refrigerator and getting a bottle of beer. And then the time came when I was fixing dinner. John had some friends that had been hunting with him. And I was fixing dinner for them, and they had a bottle of gin on the drain board. I thought I'd see how it tasted because, and how it did, because they seemed to be enjoying it so much. And I took a drink. And from then on, gin was my drink, and my troubles began. The worst times of my drinking were in the summer when I did not have to get up and go to school. One summer, my husband had to be in Jacksonville that summer with his work. And I didn't want to go to Jacksonville because I could picture myself in a hotel, a motel, or a boarding house or somewhere under supervision. So I decided to go up the mountains to North Georgia and spend the summer. We had been up there in summers before. So that was what I did. I didn't have the car. We only had one car then, and John had the car. But what he didn't know was that in summers before, when I had been up there, I found that there was a filling station on the border of North Carolina and Georgia that would sell me gin, anything else that I wanted. So every day that summer, I walked the mile, and I got my bottle. I get a pint, and I'd come back, and I drank it. When I got ready to go back to school in September, I was not able to go. I couldn't go without having something to drink. Instead of facing this situation and doing something about it, I just went to bed. I stayed in bed. Wouldn't get up. I had a yard man that would go and get me gin. I had a maid that would go and get me gin. So I just stayed. And the doctor said I had a nervous breakdown. And needed a leave of absence from school. My husband's brother is a doctor, and he was begging me to go to a hospital, and I wanted no part of a hospital. And finally, they convinced me that if I didn't go to a hospital, that I would get worse and that I would die. And what I didn't know was that they were fixing to commit me. But I told them that I would go. They said I'd just have to stay about 3 weeks and come home well. But when I got to Asheville, to Highland Hospital, they said I'd have to stay 4 months. And they said I'd die if I didn't do something about my condition. So I consented to stay. I got built up physically. I didn't weigh 100 pounds when I went to the hospital. I was so weak I couldn't walk across the room hardly. So I got built up physically. We played volleyball and tennis and all kinds of things like that. I gained 20 pounds. I couldn't stand the psychiatrist. I wouldn't tell him the truth. He blamed John for my drinking, and I knew John wasn't responsible for my drinking. When the time came for me to, nearly came for me to go back home, they didn't want me to go back. They wanted me to go to my mother. And I knew I wasn't going to do that either. So he didn't get anywhere with me. And when I left Highland Hospital and got home, the afternoon I got home, I went to tell the maid that I was back and to come the next day, and stopped and got a fifth. I didn't drink as bad then for a while. I went back to school, and I taught a year or two more, but it was getting worse and worse. It was getting harder and harder to get up and go to school. I wanted to stop long before I did, but the doctor said that he knew what would happen if I stopped. My family knew too. But I stopped and it did happen. I got worse. I did some usual things that drunks do. I lied and I used money that should have been used for other things to buy gin with. I would tell John goodbye in the mornings when he traveled, and when he was at home, I'd tell him goodbye. You don't have to worry this morning. I'm not going to drink anything. And I knew just as soon as he got out of sight, And 9 o'clock came when the liquor store would open. I'd be on my way. I didn't want to be this way. I didn't want to hurt John anymore. I didn't want to hurt my mother, my brother, my sister. But after I'd had one drink, I was powerless to stop. About this time, in the Atlanta Journal, there were some articles about Alcoholics Anonymous, written by Mr. Morgan Blake, who was an alcoholic himself, but who stopped drinking because of the teachings of the church. But he knew about alcoholism, and he knew about AA in Atlanta. My husband was reading these articles, and one Sunday afternoon in September 1943, he called Alcoholics Anonymous. Two men came out to the house. I didn't know John had even called. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. He had read the article that was in the Saturday Evening Post in 41, and had given it to me to read, but I couldn't even read. I don't remember anything about it except I saw the back of a lot of people's heads. The faces didn't show. But I heard these men say, men don't usually call on the women, and women don't call on the men. But since we're here, won't you come out and see us? And I did go out. And one of these men was Sam Daughtry, who was one of the founders of AA in Atlanta. And the other was Stanley Young. I had taught school with Stanley Young's mother. They sat in our living room and talked a couple of hours some more. Sam did most of the talking. He was a Presbyterian minister. He had a very large church in New York City. His doctor gave him a tonic because he was run down. Whiskey, egg, and milk. Take three times a day. During Prohibition, so he had a prescription to get the whiskey. One day he went to the refrigerator and there were no eggs. So he left out the eggs. The next, there was no milk. Or else he didn't want to deprive the children of the milk. So he drank it straight. He knew what was happening to him, and he knew it wouldn't be long before the people in New York would let him go. So he came to Atlanta, and he didn't drink for a good while, 6 months, maybe longer. He preached at the Westminster Presbyterian Church. But one drink, he was off again. They had to let him go from the Westminster Church. He finally landed in Chicago, working in a bank, cleaning up to get enough money to buy his whiskey. And he read in the Liberty magazine about Alcoholics Anonymous. This article came out before that, in the Post article. And he knew he wanted to come back to Atlanta where he had fallen and start over again. And that Alcoholics Anonymous was what he wanted. So he was one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta. As Sam sat there and talked, he said that he was an alcoholic. That if he took one drink, he was powerless to stop until he had no more to drink. Until he had passed out, until he couldn't get any more to drink. And that was the first time in the 20 years that I drank that anyone had told me anything that made any sense, because that was exactly the way I was. He said he couldn't tell whether I was an alcoholic or not. Only I could do that, but if I were an alcoholic and would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, would work the 12 steps of the program to the best of my ability, I could get sober and stay sober. So I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I liked the people. I liked the program. I sat on the back seat. As soon as the meeting was over, I left. This was all fine, but it was not for me, because I was going to drink again. I could handle it. But I kept going, and I didn't have a drink for 7 months. And then John's niece was getting married, and at the reception, they had two punch bowls. One had spiked, the other one didn't. I knew the one that was spiked because I saw him fix it. I went right to the spiked punch and drank spiked punch all during the reception. The next day, I got a bottle. So that was my pattern for the next 2 years. I guess I became a periodic because I would go months without drinking. And then when I thought I had a good excuse so I could get by with it, one time John was going to St. Simon's on business and I was going with him. I thought I'd just get a pint, just take a few drinks before we went. I'd leave the bottle at home and that would be the end of it. Well, John went to St. Simon's, but I didn't. I was in bed drunk. There was some AAs staying there with me. But the time came when I knew, without any shadow of a doubt, that I was an alcoholic, that my life was unmanageable. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. Knew about AA and knew about the 12 steps. I knew that I could keep on drinking. But I felt that if I did, I'd have to leave home because I couldn't subject John to any more punishment. And I debated this. And I debated it a long time, because I think I knew that this was serious. As it turned out, I think it was the most important decision that I have ever made. Because about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I made the decision that I wanted sobriety more than I wanted to drink. That was July the 4th, 1945. And when I went to sleep and slept a few hours and woke up the next morning, I knew that I would not take a drink that day. And I have known every day since that this day I will not take a drink. And 4th of July, that will be 33 years. I really became a part of Alcoholics Anonymous then. I became interested. I read the big book. I had read it before because Sam Daughtry sold John the big book that Sunday afternoon that he came to see us. He said he hated to sell it to John, but he didn't have any money. And I still have it. It was the second edition. It's a larger book than the one we have now, larger in size. I wanted everything that AA had to offer. I read what I could find about alcoholism in the library. I read the little bit of literature that we had then. I did a lot of talking Tom Burrell was a member of the one group that we had in Atlanta at that time. And he was one of the 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York. He had moved to Atlanta. He was a trustee of what we call it now the General Service Board. At that time it was a foundation. And Tom was going to have to get off of the board because he had moved away from New York. But he was waiting until he thought that Bill Wilson didn't need him. And Tom didn't mind answering my questions. He didn't mind talking to me. I heard the word traditions, and I didn't know what they were talking about. And Tom explained what the traditions were all about. That as the groups grew, new groups were forming all the time. The groups were having problems, and they didn't know what to do with them. They would write to the New York office and ask what to do about it. And they would answer the letter, and they would say, "We can't tell you what to do, but our experience has taught us that this is what is the best thing to do." And that's the way our traditions got started. I have some notes because I have some dates. This thing shakes. I'm not used to not leaning on something. About this time in Atlanta, we had to move from where we were meeting. We were meeting on Broad Street in what is now the second floor of Muse's store. And Mr. Asa Candler owned this building. And he gave us the use of it and didn't charge us any money. But he was going to remodel the building, and so we had to move. Now, AA, as such, can't spend money on rent and those kind of things. So we formed the Adeline Society, which was the fiscal agent of AA. We only had one group then, as I say, about 30 or 40 members. And this board that directed the Adeline Society was made up of a group of people that were selected from this one group. And it wasn't too long after Adeline Society was formed that they came to me and asked me if I would be on the board. I thought this was the finest thing that could have happened to me. I didn't know that they even knew that I was there hardly. I don't do a great deal of talking and rather quiet and timid. So I really thought it was quite an honor to be asked to be on the Adeline board, which it was. And I remember when I was on the board, at this time I was still dreaming that I was drinking, that I got drunk. I haven't done it in a long, long time. And I dreamed one night that I was drunk. My first thought was, I have to get off the Adeline board. When I woke up and found I was not drunk, it was a great feeling. They had told me in Alcoholics Anonymous that to do everything that I was asked to do, and I tried to do it. I would lead meetings, I tried to talk, I would clean up, I would bring cookies, do what I was asked to do. A time, we had a man that was coming every Tuesday and every Friday night from Jefferson, Georgia, to our group. He and his wife came twice a week. He told Virginia Williams and me that he and his wife were going to Memphis, Tennessee, to an AA conference, Southeastern Conference, and asked us if we didn't want to ride with them. Well, Virginia and I wanted to do anything that had to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. So we did go to this convention in September of 1947. It was the third Southeastern Convention. And Bill Wilson was at this convention, and Lois was at this convention, Marty Mann was there, and lots of other people. There were about 300 or 400 people from all over the South and other places too. And it was wonderful. And I remember just like it was today when I met Bill Wilson in the lobby at the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And when I was introduced to Bill, shook hands with him, I had the feeling that I was in the presence of a spirit. And I never lost that feeling. Bill talked about the traditions. He had written the traditions in the long form. They hadn't written them then in the short form. And he explained the traditions to us at that conference. I met people there that remain friends to me. There are not very many of them still living. I met Tom Sharp at that convention, and Tom and I are dear friends till today. Most of them are passed on. And I found out that AA was not the little 20, 30, 40 people that we had in Atlanta. That AA was bigger than that. That AA meant more than that. That we had AA all over the United States. We had AA in some foreign countries. That was something else that I was learning about AA. It made me want to know more and more. I came back home. We came back from the convention. And then, I'm going to get my sequence straight. We've talking about having a convention in a year or two, talking about having a convention in Atlanta, and we got the Southeastern Convention in Atlanta in 1951. Well, in the meantime, in 1950, they had the first international convention in Cleveland, and I didn't go to that convention. Only two people from Atlanta went, Tom Burrell and Carl T. And I didn't think I knew either one of them well enough to ask him if I could go with them. So I didn't go. But they adopted the traditions at that convention. They became the second legacy. The 12 steps were our first legacy, and the traditions became our second legacy. And that was when Dr. Bob made his last talk. Dr. Bob appeared briefly, and most of what he said was, keep it simple. He had cancer, and they knew that it was terminal, and that it wouldn't be too long before Dr. Bob was gone. And Bill got to wondering about when Dr. Bob, he knew he was couldn't live very much longer, and that he was liable to go any time, any of us were. What would happen to AA if there's no one to direct it? With Dr. Bob gone, and if he left. So the idea about the General Service Conference was born. To have a meeting every year in New York, and have each state send someone to that meeting and find out all about Alcoholics Anonymous. So if anything did happen, somebody would know what it was all about and what was happening. The board didn't want to do this. That was the reason Tom Burrell stayed on the board, because he wanted to support Bill with the third legacy, the legacy of service. So Bill went several times to see Dr. Bob to talk about it. And finally, Dr. Bob said, "It's necessary. Let's go ahead and do it, Bill." And so Helen Brown, who was one of the secretaries in the New York office, she came from Boston. Joe knew her in Boston before he came to Atlanta. Drew up what we have today, third legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was a brilliant girl, lovely person. I loved her dearly. She died a few years later. The board passed it, and so Bill got to work on the third legacy. Well, in 1951, when we had the conference in Atlanta, the Southeastern Conference, I was the program chairman of that conference. And we invited Bill to come to Atlanta. And he came, and Lois came, and Ruth Bream came from the New York office, and a lot of other speakers. And it was great. And I met Bill and Lois at the airport. And all during that conference, I was their hostess. And it was a wonderful experience. This meeting in New York, they decided to stagger the membership. The first year that they had it, in 1951, the states that had the largest membership, AA membership, would send a delegate then. And the states with the smaller membership would send the second year. So there would always be an old and a new group there. And Georgia came into the second panel. At this convention in 51, we had decided, they had asked us in New York if we would have our meeting and select the delegate from Georgia at that time. And so the group in Atlanta appointed me the representative from the Atlanta group, which we would call today the GSR, but we had no GSRs then or no committeemans. But we asked each group in the state, after this convention was over on Saturday night, Sunday morning, to meet, and we would have a meeting and select the delegate from Georgia. Well, when the time before this, when they were going to select the delegate from Florida, because the Florida delegate went in 51, we knew that we were going to have this election in Atlanta. And although we had read the Third Legacy Manual, I'm one of these people that can't read something and do it. I can see it done and then understand it, but I can't read it and do it. So we decided that we would go to Jacksonville and be down there when they had their election, so we'd see how it was done, so we'd know how to do it in Atlanta. So Carl T. and Virginia Williams and I went to Jacksonville. Bill was down there. Bill wanted to, they'd only had one other election at this time, and that was in Boston, and Bill was up there, and he conducted that. I saw that it was done like he wanted it done. So we went to Jacksonville, and Bill talked that Saturday night. And then that Sunday morning, they had the meeting and elected Tom Sharp, the first delegate from North Florida. So when we had this meeting in Atlanta, we knew the procedure. We knew what to do. And I was one of the ones that they selected to run as delegate. Marty Moncrief from Albany was another that they selected. And we had the election, and neither one of us got two-thirds majority votes. And we had two or three ballots. And Monty Moncrief said, ladies first, said I withdraw in favor of Neely. And when he did that, then I became the Georgia delegate. But we decided then that since I hadn't won and he hadn't won, that we'd have Monty as our next delegate. And that's what we did. So I went to New York that April as a delegate from Georgia, the General Service Conference. It was a wonderful experience. We were talking tonight at dinner with Keith about his experience in New York. And it's something that I just wish every member of Alcoholics Anonymous could experience. You just can't tell what it's like. You just talk to somebody that's been, and they understand what you're talking about. But they find out everything about Alcoholics Anonymous, the business, problems, anything you want to know about. And it's really worth. You get there, you eat breakfast together, you eat lunch together, you eat dinner together, and you work from 9 o'clock in the morning sometimes till midnight. It's hard work, but it's worth it. Just a wonderful experience. I guess every delegate wonders, what am I going to do now, you know, since I've been a delegate? Well, you don't have to wonder. There's always plenty to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's always work to do at the group level. There's always 12-step work. There's always something to do if you want to do it. I didn't miss it. I didn't miss not working because I didn't stop working. And I've often thought when I hear about these people that have retired and are lonesome and don't have anything to do and are just miserable, that they all ought to belong to Alcoholics Anonymous and be active in it. I have, instead of telling you how I worked the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that I would just tell you some of these things that happened and some of these things that maybe some of you don't know about. In 1953, some of us NAA met in Louisville, Georgia, because it was rather a good place to meet. I was visiting my sister in Sylvania, Georgia, which wasn't very far. Lewis and Marion Mulheron came from Augusta. Jim and Minnie O'Brien came from Savannah. Monty Moncrief and his wife came from Albany. And I was there. And we had this meeting because we thought that we would like to put on a state convention like South Carolina was doing. So we decided to put on a convention, and Lewis Mulheron said Augusta would have that convention. So we did. 1954, we had our first state convention in Augusta. And then the next year, Savannah had the state convention. And it was time to get another delegate, because I had been there in 52 and 53. So at that Savannah convention, we elected Jim O'Brien, the third delegate from Georgia to go to the General Service Conference. Then, as AA started growing, we decided that maybe we ought to have a state assembly. A good many of the people that were interested in AA at that time got together and decided that we would have a state assembly, that we would meet 3 times a year, like we do now. We would attend to the state business at this state assembly. We would elect our delegates when it was time to elect delegates at this state assembly. So we had our first state assembly here in Macon, because Macon was the center of the state. We asked each group to send a representative. By that time, they were called GSRs. And we would hold the state assembly. There weren't very many people there. We didn't have too many groups. We met in the kilowatt room of the Georgia Power Company building. And I don't know exactly how long we met in the kilowatt room. And then we went one time, to the Lanier Hotel. Met there, I think, a year or two. Then went to the Dempsey. And we met at the Dempsey Hotel until I think they tore it down or something, and then we came here. So from that small beginning, when Lewis Mulheron was our first delegate that was elected at that general, at the state assembly, he was our fourth delegate. From that small group that were there that day, small group of dedicated AAs, 22 years ago, we have today what you see here tonight. Now, this hasn't just happened. Didn't one person do this? The dedicated AAs, the AAs in Georgia, who want to serve their state and want to serve Alcoholics Anonymous, come to these meetings. They're interested, they're dedicated, they have kept this going, and we have what we have today. Because many, many people spent time and effort and interest and work to keep Georgia with the kind of AA that we have. And I think we should be proud of our AA in Georgia. I think we have just about the finest AA that we have anywhere. And I believe with me that you will dedicate your life to service, to ensure that nothing will happen to Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill used to say nothing will happen on the outside. If anything ever happens to AA, it'll happen within. And you and I do not want anything to happen within to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure. I would like, if you will, with me, to rededicate your life to doing what you can for Alcoholics Anonymous, to ensure that there will always be AA here for the new people coming in and for the millions that still do not know. I may not be with you too much longer. The law of averages say that I won't. 1 month from yesterday, I will celebrate my 80th birthday. I think I am the most fortunate person that ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. In the first place, My husband was so glad that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was sober, that he wanted me to do anything that I wanted to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. He made it possible for me to go to Memphis that day, that time. And in these years, I've only missed 2 Southeastern conventions. I went to the Second International, which met in St. Louis. And since then, I haven't missed an international. And all of these things have happened to me, not because I did anything special, not because I was deserving, but because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, doing what I, when you needed me. And I'm truly grateful to all of you. I love you dearly, and I thank Keith so much for asking me to come and talk tonight for you. All of the time that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, everything hasn't been like I would have liked it to have been. There have been troubles, there have been sorrows, there have been disappointments, but through none of it has it been necessary for me to take a drink. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has sustained me. For several years, I was worried about a situation that was happening, and I didn't know how to handle the situation. I'd never handled one like it before. I didn't know whether I handled it right. I don't know to this day whether I handled it right or not, but I did the best that I knew how. But I did worry about it. And other little things were coming along that I was concerned about. And then 2 years ago, next month, I had to go to the hospital with pneumonia. Since I had stopped drinking, before I stopped drinking, I had not been in a hospital. My health has been fairly good, and I haven't had any serious illnesses. They found that I had an infection in my lung, but they didn't know what was causing the infection. They couldn't find it, so finally they sent me home with strong antibiotics. And I took the antibiotics and had x-rays, went back to the doctor. Took more antibiotics, had more x-rays, went back to the doctor. So in September, 2 years ago, I went in the hospital for more tests, and they found the infection. And I had an operation, and they removed the middle lobe of my right lung. But it was not malignant. And I had never been sick, never been operated on, never had anything like that, and it seemed like it was a long time before I was feeling good again. And just about the time I began feeling good, just about 2 months, I've never had any trouble with my stomach in my life, without any pain or any warning, I started hemorrhaging. I had to have an emergency operation. Well, this can't be happening to me. It just can't be happening to me. But it was happening to me. It did happen to me. When I came home from the hospital, I still thought this can't happen to me. I wouldn't face it. I got very depressed. I guess that was the word. I didn't want to see anybody. Told my friends not to come to see me, that I didn't feel like sitting up talking. Didn't want to see him, that when I got ready to see him, I'd see him. And I set about healing myself. I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of meditating. I did a lot of praying. I did a lot of introspection. I wanted to know about myself. I wanted to know what was happening to me and why it was happening. I wanted to know all I could find out about me. I discovered a great deal. I discovered things that I didn't know I knew. I discovered things about some friends of mine that I had been sort of worried about. I got to where I'm sure that these things that were buried deeply in my subconscious mind were coming to the front, because I was learning a lot of things. I was getting a little stronger. And you know, when one door closes, they tell us that always another door opens. I had a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't know that I didn't want to see anybody. I hadn't seen her and I hadn't told her. She hadn't called and I told her. So the doorbell rang one day and I went to the door. She'd been playing tennis right around there in the next street in the recreational park, and dropped by to see me after a game of tennis. I think that was my first step towards reality. She didn't know it. She kept coming to see me when she played tennis, when she was in Decatur. And she became a dear, dear friend. She calls me her sponsor. I haven't sponsored anyone in AA in a long time. We have a lady sitting in the audience tonight that asked me to sponsor, and I told her that I didn't sponsor people. I felt like the younger people should do it. People that were more active than I was, people that got about more, and I wanted to be able to go whenever I wanted to go and so forth and so on. But one day in a crowd, I heard this lady say I was her sponsor. So I think I began healing more then. And well, I'm going to finish because I want to. I'm sorry for you people. The young people. I've always loved the young people. I love the young people in Atlanta. I remember Dr. Pierce Harris writing in the Atlanta Journal said that every older person should have young friends. It kept them younger. Well, I've always had young friends. I've had so many friends. But about this time last year, Bobby and I were at a meeting at Skyland, and he asked me if I wouldn't talk to the young people. And I told him, yes, I would. I think he thought he had to beg me, but he didn't, because I felt like I had a message for those young people. I wanted to tell them to get into AA, to stay in there, do their very best, and they would have a life beyond belief that it would be the best life that they could possibly find anyone. So I went to that meeting. There were about 100 young people there. And I talked, and I have never had quite such a reception as I had that night from those people. Then, at that meeting that night, there was a young lady that Joe had known. Joe Phelan had met her at a meeting in Skyland, I guess, and he told me he wanted me to meet her. And he brought her over and introduced her to me. And a few days later, she called me and asked me if she couldn't come by and pick me up and take me to the meeting that night. I can't see to drive at night. I drive in the daytime, but I can't see to drive at night. I drive to my own group because I've been going so long that I think I could go blindfolded, but that's about the only place I do drive myself. So she came by and picked me up. And she's been coming by ever since. She's beautiful. She has almost 2 years of sobriety. I'm going to ask her to stand up. She calls me her sponsor. But the time came when all this that I was doing paid off. I woke up one Sunday morning, and as I sat on the side of the bed, thinking, saying my little prayer, I knew I felt better. I felt better than how I had felt in months. I had a feeling of freedom. I felt so good, and I felt like that I wanted to write down how I felt. Write down my feelings, and I did even before I had my coffee. And I knew that I had done everything that I knew to do to find out what was the matter with me and to get myself back like I wanted to be. And I have never felt as free as I felt then, except that I have felt that way ever since. And that was about last July when this happened. I knew that I didn't have to worry anymore about the little problems that I was worrying about, was concerned about. And from that day to this, I have not worried a bit about them. I try to do the best that I know how to do. And I have a feeling that I am doing what God wants me to do. First time in my life that I have felt close enough to God to feel that I was doing what He wanted me to do. Before, you know, I'd say, well, I must do this today. But I wanted to or not, I ought to do it. I don't feel that way anymore because I feel like the things that I'm doing, the things that I want to do, are the things that He wants me to do. And it's a wonderful feeling. Each day, I only have one day. That's all any of us have. And if I can live the best that I know how that day, that I don't have to worry about tomorrow. I listen to Dr. Shuler at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning from California. He gives a sermon. And he'd been preaching about climbing the mountains and reaching the peak and then going on up a little higher to the next peak. And this Sunday, he was talking about reaching the highest peak. And he said, what do you do when you reach that peak? And he said, you look up, you look around, you look down, and you see all these people struggling to get up to where you are. I had thought during this time that I was doing this inventory of myself, that maybe I better stop going to AA, that maybe I was too much trouble, maybe it was too much bother for people to come and get me. And said, maybe I just better stay at home. But this Sunday, that I had this feeling of freedom, I knew that I was not going to stand on the side of the road and watch AA go by. That I was going to get in there and go by with AA. That I was going to reach my hand down and try to help anyone coming up the mountain that I could, do what I could to help them. I thank each one of you, every one of you. I love you dearly. And as I said, I think I am the most fortunate person that ever came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that the rest of the time that I have, that I can be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was Sir Francis Drake that said, on the eve of an attack in the Spanish Armada, that it is not the beginning, but the continuing of the same until it is entirely finished that yields the greatest glory. Thank you.